From Michigan Public, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, cuts proposed at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration would shutter a Great Lakes data network, one that aids fishermen and helps forecast threats to beaches and drinking water.
The Great Lakes supports a variety of uses. It supports agriculture, it supports commerce. There's a real national security implication to risks when it comes to freshwater risks.
And we bring you the latest episode of Michigan Public's series, Beyond the Shore. This time to Lake Superior.
One of the things with our youth groups that was beautiful to hear was that somebody brought up about, what about the fish? Like, what do they want? And I really felt like they heard that we're sharing this landscape with other beings and they have a right for decisions too.
All that and more coming up today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Later this hour, we're headed to Lake Superior for a story about treaty rights, industrial pollution, and what it means to be in relationship to the inland sea.
As a tribal fisherman, he sees what comes up in the nets and what doesn't. And a couple decades ago, his uncle and his dad fished these waters a little closer to shore. It had always been a good fishing spot for them, until it seemed it wasn't.
That's coming up in just a bit. But first, the upcoming fiscal year budget from the Trump administration for the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA, is proposing, for the second time, to cut funding for the Integrated Ocean Observing System of the Great Lakes. Try to think of this as the nervous system of the coast and the Great Lakes. Buoys, radar, underwater gliders, and satellites that sense conditions under the water and above, and then send signals to forecasters, emergency responders, shipping operators, water managers, and others who need information about what's happening on our inland seas. As you can guess, ships use the data to navigate. Beachgoers and swimmers might get warnings about dangerous currents or riptides or even contaminated water with this info. The system also detects things like toxic algal blooms early so that water treatment managers and health officials can warn the public before people start getting sick. Here to talk with us about the funding cuts is Jennifer Bamey. She's the chief executive officer of GLOSS, the Great Lakes Observing System. This is the only regional association supporting our Lakes Data Network. Jennifer Bamey, welcome to Stateside.
Thanks very much for having me today.
May I ask, could you sort of explain the trickle-down of the funding? What exactly gets cut if the IOOS, the International Ocean Observing System, gets defunded?
Sure. So GLOSS has been operating in the Great Lakes region for 20 years. And so we've accumulated a large number of partners over that time. We coordinate data from more than 230 monitoring stations and make it free to anyone who wants it. We don't own all those buoys and towers. We coordinate with a network of partners who do. So that includes universities, federal agencies, state programs, other nonprofits. We certify their data meets federal data quality standards and integrate it into a single platform called Seagull. So you could open up your phone and go to seagull.gloss.org and see all of the deployments that are accessible across all five Great Lakes. And so what we also do as part of that process is transform that information into data usable for weather forecasting models and legal for use in agency decisions and useful by all of the partners that you've already mentioned. And so what happens with sequential federal, when you hear federal program cut, you can imagine a government office going down or going dark. What actually happens here is a cascade. So buoy maintenance contracts lapse, sensor transmission fees go unpaid, partner universities lose access to grants that keep their equipment in the water. Seagull, our data platform, eventually goes offline because the data systems that feed it are also offline. Each failure makes the next one worse, so that event builds. And rebuilding the system isn't just a matter of writing a new check. The system is maintained by relationships, quality certifications, and seasonal deployments. And that's what makes this network function. And it takes years to reconstruct. So you can't unlose a winter's worth of data if the money isn't there to support those deployments.
Can you maybe give us an example of what you mean? I think it might be possible for people to assume that data collection is automated. But what's an example of the relationships that make the whole thing work?
So sure. So for instance, we have a relationship with Michigan Technological University on Lake Superior. And every year they move the buoys out of their storage facilities, load them on boats, and take them out onto the lake and deploy them in the same or relatively similar locations year after year so that we have long-term data. We have to do this every year because the Great Lakes has significant ice cover over the winter. So we can't leave our buoys and deployable assets on the lakes or they'll get crushed. So every year we have to budget for deployment and retrieval of those assets, but the money has to arrive in time so that we can put things in the water this month. Most of our items go into the water in April and May. So right now is when we're building up our capacity to monitor during the summer season, which is high use for not just recreation, but this is when most of the commercial shipping traffic moves through the region. And so it's really important that we have funding so that our partners can do the work and put the assets in the water so that then the data moves from those assets into Seagull. And if you try and access Seagull during the winter months, you'll see there's just really not much out there. It's because we've had to pull out those assets in. And so this is very important for the data in the Great Lakes region that we can support the seasonal deployments on time so we don't have a gap.
Can you explain why it would not be possible to just reconnect with all of those people and those craft later in the season?
So part of you could connect with folks later in the season if they still have students or professionals working for them to help with those deployments. Contracts are signed to support large periods of time for deployment and retrieval. And if folks can't pick up those contracts regularly, they will go elsewhere and we lose that capacity for deployment. And they'll find other activities to keep themselves busy during the summertime. Over time, what that means is people who were supporting deployments are no longer working in that field. So we lose that capacity within the region to do the deployments at all. And so those institutional relationships are based on consistency. And part of that consistency also has a human impact. It's certainly related to data. The consistency of the data over time is what enables us to provide good information to the National Weather Service to improve their forecasting, good information to the Coast Guard if they have to go out and do retrievals or respond to oil spills or do rescue activities. That type of consistency is really important. And if the buoy just isn't there, that puts those different operations at risk.
So if someone who's out on the water, a ship's captain or a Coast Guard officer, needs that data, what kind of changes might that make in how they're able to understand what's coming?
So the information that is provided on our platform Seagull is provided in real time. And so, for example, there are several places within the lakes where commercial ship captains and have to pause in their operations and wait for a go or no go signal based on weather conditions. And if we don't provide the information to support those real-time decision-making processes, different decisions have to be made. Ships stay in port longer, not as much cargo gets transferred between different regions. And so this can impact the overall transport of cargo throughout the Great Lakes. It also impacts whether or not people feel safe going to the beach. It can impact whether or not a charter boat captain will take their fishers out for the day. These are all decisions that get made in real time. And we know that for our Seagull platform, 30% of our users are the professional users, the water managers, the ship captains, and so forth, that are making decisions in a professional environment. But 70% are folks who are using the lakes and for recreation purposes and for livelihood purposes. And this is, you know, what we're trying to do is make sure that there's a consistency of information no matter what kind of decision you're trying to make when you're in and on the lakes.
Jennifer, this is the second time the administration has proposed this cut. Can you share with us a little bit about what happened last budget cycle and how close it came to happening?
You're right. This is the second consecutive year the same elimination has been proposed. Congress said no last time. The FY26 president's budget proposed the same cut to IUS regional observations, and Congress rejected it with bipartisan support and actually increased IUS funding in the enacted bill. So we were very happy to see that. Great Lakes senators and representatives reviewed what this network does and decided that it was worth protecting. We are working toward the same outcome this year. To be honest, the operational complications that this type of uncertainty causes, even when the funding ultimately comes, it can be significant, and we are experiencing that right now in terms of shifting funding and shifting timelines. These seasonal deployments run on tight weather windows, and when funding is unresolved into the spring, buoys don't go into the water on time. The data gap will happen regardless of whether the appropriations vote turns out positive in the fall. And that is a product of how we monitor the Great Lakes and how we're able to engage in the summer versus the winter time. Now, we're working really hard to try and increase our data capacity to gather information in the winter, but that's still something that's an area of growth.
We need to take a quick break now. More on the threat of cuts to NOAA on the Great Lakes when we return. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. I'm speaking today with Jennifer Bamey. She's Chief Executive Officer of the Great Lakes Observing System. It receives its primary funding through the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, and its parent department is facing deep cuts in federal funding. The administration has framed these cuts in terms of eliminating waste. Is there a cost argument to the work that the system does?
I think the argument regarding efficiency, I certainly hear that, but what gets lost is the local expertise and the ability to make decisions at the local level. So one of the hallmarks of the Integrated Ocean Observing System is the fact that it moves decision-making on where assets get deployed to the regions themselves. So NOAA and the National Weather Service have national priorities for where and how they deploy. But what we get to do at GLOSS is engage with partners on the ground, whether it's municipalities, water treatment plant managers, beach managers, local communities who are trying to determine what they need to do about flooding and inundation, and have them tell us where they think the next buoy, the next shoreline camera, the next tower should go. And that's driven by local needs. And trust me, if a buoy goes down and fishermen are using it, they will call very quickly. So that's part of the value here. A commercial satellite can tell you a lot. It can't tell you what's happening in Saginaw Bay on a specific Tuesday morning when an algal bloom might be forming, the way this type of sensor network can, which has been specifically designed for that purpose. And it's maintained by people who know it.
Jennifer, can you say a little bit more about how GLOSS feeds into our understanding of water quality and how water treatment plants and public health, like what kinds of information they're relying on from you?
Sure. So GLOSS maintains a series of coastal buoys, and those are deployed for various purposes. We've certainly been engaged since the Toledo water crisis, where they had to shut down their water treatment plants because of harmful algal blooms being entrained in the water treatment system. And so since that time, we've been engaged with partners to continue deployments in Lake Erie, but also monitor for new harmful algal bloom formation. So unfortunately, you can find harmful algal blooms in Lake Superior now. We engage both on the monitoring side to identify where these blooms are occurring, and we also engage on the detection side so that folks have information on where the blooms are and how dangerous they are. So we're supporting new research into detecting toxins. Not every algal bloom becomes toxic, and we need to understand why. So there's a couple of different places where GLOSS information can be valuable. Ultimately, it helps not just the water treatment managers, but frankly, if someone wants to take their dog to a beach, it would be nice to know if it's safe to let their dog go in the water. And so that's part of what we're trying to achieve in the context of developing new data products based on Seagull.
Yeah. I think that the Integrated Ocean Observation System only has, like, the GLOSS is the only freshwater regional network in the whole system. I mean, I guess that's not surprising given the size and the primacy of the Great Lakes. But do you think that makes our waterways in some ways uniquely vulnerable? Like you say, there really isn't, it sounds like there's not really another monitoring system that's set up to work in this way for our region.
I mean, that I think that's correct. I think that's right. The Great Lakes are uniquely positioned for swimmable, fishable, drinkable uses. And that is different than the Salty Coast partners that we have. In that context, there's a lot more direct engagement with folks who visit the lakes and live on the lakes. That type of engagement is much more hands-on and much more direct. And I think that the folks who appreciate the lakes because we live here and appreciate the lakes because they come here to enjoy them, that's a very important part of how we think about this region. And it also raises a lot of different concerns. The Great Lakes supports a variety of uses. It supports agriculture. It supports commerce. There's a real national security implication to risks when it comes to freshwater risks that go along with using the lakes. And those can be human health and safety risks. Those could be maritime safety risks. Those can be, there's a variety of different places where information delivered promptly can make the difference in decisions on how to use the lakes and whether to engage or whether to stay home.
Many people who are involved in shipping or agriculture or some of these other fields we've been talking about are probably keenly aware of the importance of this information. But I do feel like GLOSS's work is part of a larger back of the house infrastructure that this country has to keep our water assets safe and navigable and functional. Is there anything else that you wish more people understood about the role that science plays in this?
So I think one of the places that GLOSS is really trying to engage is putting information in the hands of new users. I think it's important to understand that all of this information is currently being funded through federal sources. And, Michigan as a state can't pick this up alone if it goes away, and neither can a private company, to be frank. The value of this network is that it is a network. We have 10 other sister organizations, and so all of our information can be accumulated to national benefit. In addition, we also serve data from our partners in Canada. The Great Lakes are being We've been talking about it from the context of Michigan, but the Great Lakes are managed in concert with many communities nationally and internationally. And so I think that it's important for folks to understand that this is a collective effort. And a state program could not fund buoys for all five Great Lakes. They might fund for their own shorelines, but it's important to have information that crosses the entire region in order to manage and engage and enjoy the lakes effectively. There's so much about these lakes that we don't understand. And in order to get to a point of better understanding, we need to have a viewpoint within the system that focuses on regional needs, as well as collectively, how can we best bring as much information to the table as possible so that we make the right decisions. This publicly funded network was built to fill those gaps that you have in terms of paying customers versus states' interests. And this is the gap that will reopen if funding disappears.
Jennifer Boehm is the Chief Executive Officer of GLOSS, the Great Lakes Observing System. Jen, thank you so much for your time and for your work.
Thanks so much.
Lake Superior is important to many Michiganders. Its sheer size and volume is just majestic. And it's the lake that the UP claims without the interference of those of us living below the bridge. But for some communities, Lake Superior holds a great deal of historical and cultural significance, too. That's the subject of the latest episode of Michigan Public's new podcast, Beyond the Shore. Let's take a listen.
There's moments where I'll watch the sunrise over the horizon, and I'm steaming full ahead to my fishing grounds. And as many times I see a sunrise on the lake, it never gets old. It never gets old, so it's just kind of like watching that over and over. I'm like, yeah, I like what I do.
The life of a tribal fisherman on Lake Superior is not always easy, but it comes with its perks. These fishermen are exercising rights guaranteed to them in treaties signed with the government more than a century and a half ago. And it brings with it a unique connection and a unique understanding of Lake Superior. You're listening to Beyond the Shore from Michigan Public. I'm Rebecca Williams. This is the fourth of five stories about the Great Lakes. One story per lake. A snapshot that tells a story about each one of the lakes, a sort of microcosm of what makes each lake unique. Chapter 4, Lake Superior. Its ancient origins and the people who stay connected to its waters through tradition. For this episode, I'm handing things over to Michigan Public's Dustin Dwyer.
Okay, so not to be too dramatic about it, but the story literally begins more than 1 billion years ago with an event of unimaginable violence. The earth cracked open, magma welling up to the surface.
And it's erupting just oceans of magma onto the surface of the earth.
And the earth, it's, well, first, this is Erica Vai. She's a professor at Michigan Technological University in Houghton. She's met me and our digital director, Jody Westrick, at the A.E. Seaman Mineral Museum there, which has this beautiful collection that shows the amazing geologic history of the Keweenaw Peninsula, that unique craggy arm of land that reaches out into the middle of Lake Superior. Erica's a geologist. More specifically, she studies something called geoheritage, the connection between geology and human societies. Anyway, this event she's talking about, 1.1 billion years ago, an ocean of magma pouring out, and the Earth, it's splitting apart here, trying to create a new ocean in the middle of the continent. But for some reason, it doesn't split all the way. It stops. Then, over the course of thousands of years, the magma cools, and as it does so, it's sagging under its own weight.
So that's essentially the birth of Lake Superior, that having that basin shape.
Over the billion years, it could have filled in with sediment, but instead there was this massive sheet of ice you've probably heard about, nearly 2 miles high, Erica says. About 10,000 years ago, it started to melt.
And as that's melting or retreating, it's filling in that basin that was created 1.1 billion years ago.
Not the ocean, it could have been, but it left behind one of the largest freshwater lakes on the planet. And here on the Keweenaw Peninsula, it left something else behind, too.
Enter the story of the copper.
Erica says back when all that magma was flowing, it took a long time to cool, like thousands of years. And as it did, gases would pour out from deeper in the earth, creating bubbles and cracks, and also bringing up copper.
These hydrothermal fluids that are being brought up from the deep earth, carrying this gift of copper, and they're going to find any crack and crevice they can find to hide. And so those flow tops, where you've got those little air bubbles that are frozen in time, are a great place for copper to fill in.
The lake and the copper, they share a history, even today. Because once humans came along, the copper didn't stay in the ground. For thousands of years, people have collected it and mined it in the Keweenaw Peninsula. And starting 150 years ago or so, they started taking a lot more of it. And the leftovers of that massive mining effort have become a part of Lake Superior's story now.
This will hang out over the side so you're not pulling the nets up right next to the boat. And then that hand goes in there to span the gap. And then this grabs it. Grabs it and pulls the net in.
Chris Peterson is showing me the machine that hauls up the fishing nets on his 50-foot commercial fishing boat, the Three Suns.
The first time I ever ran this boat, it was 100% different than being a deckhand. And I eventually grew to like it.
Chris took it over from his father decades ago. Chris's family moved to the Keweenaw Peninsula from Wisconsin. He's a member of the Red Cliff Band of Lake Superior Chippewa. Fishing is a tradition and a right guaranteed to Great Lakes tribes in treaties signed with the federal government. Those treaty rights haven't always been respected, but tribal fishermen fought to reassert them. Chris's own family has filed lawsuits to protect their right to fish, not just in Wisconsin, but throughout Lake Superior. He stands at the wheel, chugging out to his fishing nets in Lake Superior in early March. He says he didn't always want to be a fisherman.
No. I was going to college and, you know, I was going to do something else. But when I was in college, I went to junior college in Escanaba, Michigan, at Bay College, and I would be looking out the window during classes, wondering how the weather was or how the fishing was going. And so I kind of came back to it.
It's not what he thought he wanted, but it turned out to be a calling.
I mean, I'm good at it now. Made a lot of money doing it, so, you know, put my two daughters through school, so. You know, I'm good at it. You gotta get it in your blood. You gotta fall in love with doing it, hunting fish, you know.
When Chris spots the buoy marking his next net, he steps down from the captain's bench and stands at the side of the boat where there's a second wheel and an open panel next to the rotating wheel that pulls the net through. The deck of the boat is enclosed. Heaters are blasting to keep it warm inside. It smells of fish guts, marine grease, and Chris's Marlboros. Chris reaches out for his buoy and gets the net started into the machine. The net spills out onto a white table where four men stand, one guiding the net at one end, one stuffing it into a bin at the other end, and two in the middle, pulling the fish free from the net and chucking them into a plastic box on the floor. It's slow at first, only a few fish appear at a time. It's a mixture of trout and whitefish.
So, I mean, we had something, but not what I'm looking for. I need bigger numbers than that. I mean, at least a box of whitefish would be nice.
Chris tells me he put his lines out a little shallower than he usually would. He wasn't sure how many fish he'd get. He has his favorite spots already picked out. He's one of the few large boat commercial fishermen on the lake. So he sees it more. As a tribal fisherman, he sees what comes up in the nets and what doesn't. And a couple decades ago, his uncle and his dad fished these waters a little closer to shore, in shallower water where there's an underwater pile of rocks known as Buffalo Reef. It had always been a good fishing spot for them, until it seemed it wasn't. Chris says his uncle mentioned it to some people at the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission, Glyphwick.
You know, we had told whoever, Glyphwick, that they weren't catching no fish. I don't know if he said because of stamp sands or not, but he said something's up with Buffalo Reef. And eventually he ended up finding out that all that tailings was drifting off of there, blowing off of there, and covering up that reef.
Scientists began studying the reef, and what they found underwater on the rocks traced back to the shore, to the history 1.1 billion years ago, to the copper. The reason the fish weren't on the reef was because of the leftovers from two copper mines that operated a century ago near the shore here. The mines operated by pulling chunks of rock out of the ground and smashing them into bits. The copper bits were separated out, but there was lots of coarse leftover so-called stamp sands or tailings that had trace amounts of copper. The mine operators just dumped it all on the beach, 23 million metric tons of it. Over time, the copper-infused sands drifted onto the reef. The Environmental Protection Agency says copper can be toxic to fish in higher concentrations. And the scientists who studied Buffalo Reef found fish had started to avoid spawning there. The copper history is evident everywhere you go in the Keweenaw Peninsula. This area has the largest deposit of what's known as native copper anywhere in the world. The copper taken from here is the same copper used in the wires that brought electricity to every home in America a century ago. And people up here are still dealing with the leftovers.
We need to take a quick break. More from Lake Superior with Beyond the Shore when we return. You're with Stateside. I'm April Baer. Let's get back now to reporter Dustin Dwyer's story about Lake Superior from the latest episode of Michigan Public's podcast, Beyond the Shore.
Chris Peterson steers the three sons back to the icy dock with several boxes of fish. It's not as many as he'd hoped for, but enough to restock the fish market. Waiting for us on the dock is Bob Cowpey. He lives here and owns the dock.
You grew up around here?
Yeah.
Do you remember the sands always being there?
There were a lot more sand when I was a kid.
Yeah.
The reason this dock is here is because in 1915, there was so much sand pumped in a lake that they had to harbor in the mouth of the back of the river. And my grandpa couldn't put his boat in no more, so they came down here and started building this, their own dock, their own harbor. And the sand was out a mile and an eighth out in the lake when they closed the mill in 1932.
Jeez.
It was a big deal.
Yeah.
The old smokestack from the mine still pokes above the trees just down the beach. Snow covers the sands while we're there. But for nearly a century, storms have swept the sands down the beach, under the waves, on top of Buffalo Reef.
They call that the dead zone because when a fry is born on the reef, they head to the shallow water, but there's no food for them there. They have to go to past the Traverse to get food. So that's why that's a big deal, that spawning ground. See?
They have to go past the Traverse River farther south. If left alone, scientists say the sands will continue to drift over the reef, covering even more of it. The fish like rocky places like Buffalo Reef for spawning because it has all these nice secret spaces. The sands bury those perfect little spots, and the traces of copper that remain in the sand are also potentially toxic to the fish. Nearly a decade ago, the Environmental Protection Agency created a new Buffalo Reef Task Force to study how to stop the spread of stamp sands on the reef. Since then, there's been annual dredging, and there's a plan for how to remove much of the sand to stop its spread. The problem is that plan could cost $2 billion. So, for now, the state and tribes are just doing maintenance, digging up sands from one end of the beach, trucking them to the other, away from the reef, just slowing it down enough to keep things kind of in check. A big part of that work right now and in the future is coming from the Keweenaw Bay Indian community.
I see a fishy! He's swimming! I see a fishy swimming!
Destiny Lunsfa is watching her bait fish swim through the hole in the ice. Each February, the Keweenaw Bay Indian community hosts a free ice fishing day for local families. This year, it was on the water at the head of the bay next to the Sand Point Lighthouse. Grace Juntinen stood on the ice with her family, including Destiny, over what the fish finder said was 40 feet of water.
What kind of fish are you going to catch?
Any. Actually, trout and whitefish run through this place.
Well, what's your intention, though? What do you want?
Trout.
You really want trout?
Why? We smoke the fish that we catch.
Trout's your favorite?
Yeah.
The event is organized by the Keweenaw Bay Indian Community's Natural Resources Department. Evelyn Ravindran is the director. She's standing on the ice wearing a blue coat and sunglasses. She'd walked around greeting people fishing through the ice. Evelyn's other name, she tells me, is Laughing Water Woman.
That was the name that was gifted to me many years ago. I'm with Bear Clan, and my name really reflects my ties to Lake Superior and to the waters of this area, that there's a joy, and this is home to me, and I need this as a touchstone every day of my life. You know, that it's very important to me what happens, and I stay connected to these waters.
Whether it's on the ice, or standing on the beach as the waves roll in, or swimming, she says she tries to connect with this water every single day.
It's a balance, a connectedness to the water and to the beings that are here that share the same landscape as us. It's important for me to know what's happening and that I'm interacting in a good way and that I'm sharing this with my community and I'm hearing what they say then too. And they're sharing with me on their feelings about things that are happening out here. I think that was the most important thing, that we always keep this connection very strong.
She says she's always felt that connection herself, and it's what drew her to the work in the Natural Resources Department. She started out managing a tiny fish hatchery more than 20 years ago. Now she manages a full staff, and she sits on the Buffalo Reef Task Force. The task force has recommended creating a landfill inland to deposit the stamp sands from the shore and building a jetty to block the flow of what remains.
Some of the things that have to be looked at take years. And I know, like, the process of Buffalo Reef, if you look at the timeline of it, like, the are coming to know what was happening there and getting a group together and working on, we're talking decades. But as has been expressed in those meetings and with the community around here, we're not going anywhere. And whether it takes 100 years, we're still here, we're still working on it, it's still an obligation, it's still something that's important to us and that we have to keep on working on.
That word, obligation, is a big word when it comes to the tribe's work and connection to this lake. There are the obligations that come from the tribe's treaties with the U.S. government. The 1842 treaty, which is the one signed by the Keweenaw Bay Indian community, is often called the Mineral Treaty, Evelyn tells me. The U.S. government had already signed a treaty in 1836 for tribes in the eastern UP. But in 1841, state geologist Douglas Houghton published a survey describing in detail the apparent copper formations in the Keweenaw Peninsula. The next year, the U.S. government entered into a treaty that covered the peninsula. That treaty gave the U.S. the right to mine the copper. It also gave tribal members the right to continue fishing, which is what Chris Peterson's uncle and dad were doing when they discovered that fish were avoiding Buffalo Reef. For Evelyn, that points to the other obligations. Obligations not in the 1842 treaty or the 1836 treaty, but in what the tribe considers the first treaty, the treaty with the Creator. Out on Keweenaw Bay, the ice fishing wraps up. Evelyn leads me back to the snowy shore, where kids are eating hot dogs and adults are sitting around the fire. Evelyn tells me events like this one are important to introduce more kids to fishing, to teach them the traditions and obligations of that first treaty.
One of the things with our youth groups that was beautiful to hear was that somebody brought up about, what about the fish? Like, what do they want? And I really felt like they heard that we're sharing this landscape with other beings and they have a right for decisions too.
We reach the shore where folks are still gathering around, kids climbing snow piles up to tree branches, adults starting to clean up. We find Evelyn's brother, Paul Smith. He's the owner of First Catch LLC, another commercial fishing operation. Evelyn says she doesn't go out on Paul's boats as much as she did when they were younger. There was one time when they were out in a boat together when the wind picked up and the motor cut off, and as Paul tried to fix the motor, it slipped off the back of the boat into the water, and they ended up having to row in.
And there's always, it seems like, there's a story that's associated when her and I get on the same vessel.
And I say the same thing.
Though Paul grew up fishing, he says he didn't always think he was going to be a fisherman. but the water kept drawing him back.
There's moments where I'll watch the sunrise over the horizon, and I'm steaming full ahead to my fishing grounds. And as many times I see a sunrise on the lake, it never gets old. It never gets old, so it's just kind of like watching that over and over. And I'm like, yeah, I like what I do.
He makes money at it, but he doesn't see it as completely different from the work his sister does in conservation with the Natural Resources Department.
So as it being like it's kind of taking, no, I mean, it's more for me like stewardship. And I think that stewardship played into noticing problems such as what's happening in the Buffalo Reef area, or you know, biologists and scientists will say one thing, but when you're watching it happen with your harvest, you're like, well.
The tribal fishermen just see the lake differently. For now, Paul, his sister, and even Chris Peterson, they all agree on one thing. To them, Lake Superior is the healthiest of the Great Lakes. Lake Superior is different. The people who know it best say you can feel that difference. Over by the fire, I find Kathleen Smith.
Bonjour. Wasa Node Queen Ajinakaz, Mayingan Hindo Dem, Anishinaabe, Mede Queen, Dawe Queen Dung, and Dunjaba. So my name is Kathleen Smith. I'm here as a community member today since I'm enrolled here at Keweenaw Bay Indian Community in this beautiful space. But my profession, I work for Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission. My position there is Gunawangdum Manoman, she who takes care of the wild rice.
Kathleen tells me she's a water walker, which means she's part of a tradition to honor and protect the waters of the Great Lakes. She takes part in ceremonies where she carries the water over the land, walking it for many miles.
We walk from the Natural Resources Department, where they're located out there in Pequaming at First Sand, and we walk 17 miles, and we end here at the lighthouse. So I'm also a water walker. So our women in our culture, in the Anishinaabe Kwe, we are the caretakers for the water.
The water from the lake is carried in a vessel made out of copper. And she tells me about the water walk movement. And a woman she calls Grandmother Josephine, Josephine Mondamin, who said that when she walked with Lake Erie water, it felt heavier because of the pollution affecting that lake.
Yes. What do you feel, describe it to me, when you're doing a water walk, how do you feel Lake Superior water, how does that feel different for you?
When I sing and pray for that water and as I carry that copper vessel, my feet actually become lighter and I just want to race to the end.
It feels different with carrying Lake Superior water than other water.
It feels so different, you know, in this community. I'm really partial to Keweenaw Bay, you know, because it's a bigger part of Lake Superior, but that's the difference, you know, is that it's so much lighter.
I asked Kathleen, with her tribal connection to this water, what she knows that the rest of us, especially non-tribal people, may not know.
So water is very healing. Very healing. When you sit right next to the water, you know, it just kind of soothes you. So we've all have that. No matter what your walk of life, no matter what your belief system is, we all have that connection, you know, to the landscape, to this beautiful Gitchigumi, to Lake Superior. And what we do with our teachings is we just remind you of your connection as well for non-tribal people. You know, it takes a tribe to really exercise their treaty rights and to really stand for, you know, what's ours, you know, from since beginning of time. And to really fight for those treaty rights, we're actually also fighting for you too. For water quality standards, you know, for our tribe is like one of the first tribes that have advocated for that. And it's how important it is, you know, for all of us to really understand that we're here just to remind you of what you already know.
What you already know, what we already know, is that this lake is ancient, formed in the hot fire of an ocean of magma, created by melting ice, carrying precious resources below its waves and on the shore. What you already know is that what we do here now affects what comes next, just as what was done before affects us now. And the people who lived here, the people who live here, have an obligation to keep that in mind.
Next time on Beyond the Shore, we go on a road trip to follow the American eel.
Eels are mysterious.
Come along for the ride as we unravel the unbelievable journey of the eel, from Lake Ontario to the open ocean, the final chapter in our series on the Great Lakes.
Among other stories we're following, there have been some big innovations made in recent years for energy storage. Michigan has some pretty ambitious clean energy targets on the books coded into law. It also has an ambitious law for utility-scale battery energy storage. That means there are a lot of battery projects in the pipeline, and local governments are having to make quick decisions on how to handle them. Michigan Public's Sarah Swick explains.
In 2023, Michigan became the first Midwest state to set a goal for battery energy storage. That's because with more wind and solar power in the mix, utilities need a place to store that energy when it's generated, then distribute it later when demand peaks. In simple terms, battery storage helps stabilize the grid. And Public Act 233 says Michigan needs to have 2,500 megawatts of it by 2029. But as of right now, there's just one utility-scale battery project up and running. It's a 100-megawatt installation in South Central Michigan's Branch County, and it's not much to look at. 80 rectangular boxes, basically semi-trailers, are spread out in groups of two.
So you got 40 groups, and in each one, they've got their own alarm systems. They have their own suppression systems.
That's Coldwater Township Supervisor Don Rogers. The boxes are spread out like that because the lithium-ion batteries inside can sometimes overheat. And if a fire breaks out, it can't be put out with water, hence the alarm and fire suppression systems. So that's a concern. But mostly Rogers calls battery energy storage a win-win scenario. Developers and their utility partners win, of course. And Rogers says it sets up a reliable stream of money and other benefits for the host communities.
The long-term sustainability of these projects to provide revenue for the township, for the schools, for the county, and for the entire area is a major upside.
As the first place in Michigan to host utility-scale battery storage, Rogers says Coldwater Township is constantly welcoming other local officials who want to see it for themselves.
We've had numerous municipalities come and visit and look at the setup and the system.
That's because under the law, communities can't just say no to renewable energy developers. If they do, or if the two sides can't reach an agreement, the developers can take it to state utility regulators instead. And in that case, the community could end up with a very generic, bare-bones ordinance. Rogers says that's why he urges local government leaders to try their best to reach an agreement with developers.
Work with them. Have a dialogue. Don't push them away. Don't put up a roadblock until you talk to them and find out.
But in one small West Michigan community, some residents say they'd rather take their chances with the state.
You're at Little Pistol Farms. We're a 29-acre pumpkin and produce farm.
That's Katie Schneider. She and her husband, Ken, became what she calls accidental farmers committed to environmentally friendly practices here in Oshtemo Township last year. Schneider says that's one reason she became concerned when she heard that a battery energy storage project was planned right next door, literally.
That would be our neighbor's property. The closest they can start is 50 feet from his property line.
The first Schneider heard about the project was last fall, and she was upset to find the developer had leased the land from another neighbor several years ago. She dove into researching battery storage and got even more concerned. The risk of fire that could release toxic gases, for example, mandatory fencing that could be a barrier to local wildlife. And Ken Schneider says the hum that comes along with large-scale battery projects is a particular concern.
The inverters put out a high-pitched frequency that bees don't like. It drives away bees. Without bees, our farm goes bankrupt.
All of this has led to political turmoil in Oshtemo Township. There's now a recall effort to remove multiple township officials from office. Renewable energy experts say the concerns raised in Oshtemo Township are valid, but they also say battery storage technology has gotten both more efficient and much safer in just the past couple of years. And with more than 2,000 megawatts of storage to deploy in just the next 3 years, the learning curve for local governments and citizens is steep. And right now, they just don't have many examples they can learn from. For Michigan Public, I'm Sarah Swick.
That's all for Stateside today. I'm April Bear. Have a great weekend. Stay safe. We'll see you Monday.